Well, David described the origin of this session very accurately. And so let me just make a few introductory remarks. I guess one just sort of personal note is that I don't know how I got to be vice president, president-elect of the American Physical Society, because this was not something that that I had been that much involved in for a large part of my career. A little bit in and out and stuff like that, but it was for most of my career, the American Physical Society was an organization that existed. It did sort of standard things like publish the Physical Review. And run a few meetings, and you sort of took it for granted. And in fact, Hans Bethe, when he was here last, and just shortly after this election, mentioned to me, he said, well, I was president of the APS at one time. I said, yes, I knew. He said, but it was a very different job then. We all, the presidents of the APS did, was they just did what K.K. Darrow or Havens told them to do, whoever was the executive officer at the time, and it was pretty much an organization that ran itself. As Hans knew, and I knew very well, that just isn't the case anymore. It's got the APS has become a professional society that does a whole lot of things that need to be done for the professional health of the physics community, and it's just within the last few years, as a matter of fact, becoming a very sort of a leader in the business of electronic publication, things of that kind, in an area where not too many years ago it was the sort of the dinosaur. It had to do this, and it has a few people involved that I think are really very good. So when I got sort of sucked into this, instead of saying, no, I'm too busy, I don't have time for these sort of pro forma activities, I found myself irresistibly getting more and more involved over just the last few years. And although I will talk now as an advocate for what the APS is doing, because I've become fairly enthusiastic about how it's doing what it's doing. I have no illusions that it's doing everything just right, and I certainly know very well that it's got a lot of baggage, and that's why I'm particularly interested to have a two-way conversation today. Let me start then just by making a few introductory remarks, tell you a few things about topics that I think are interesting, and then take questions and comments from you and just start the discussion, and you can sort of point me towards what topics are most interesting. Basically, there are two things that the APS concerns itself with. Health of the profession and publications. And as far as division of activities is concerned, if you put dollars to it, this is about 80%, maybe more. Of the operation, but that's simply because publishing how many issues? Five, depending on how you count it, issues per month of physical, six maybe per month of Physical Review and Physical Review Letters and Reviews of Modern Physics, and a bunch of other things now is a big business, and I certainly want to get onto that. But
80% of the expenditure or 80% of the income?
The through flow. It's not 80% of the. The APS is a non-profit organization. Essentially everything. What? Now, basically, it spends and takes in about $30 million a year. Not trivial. About 25 million of that is income and expense associated with the publications, and the other 5 million has to do with meetings, outreach, political lobbying, and things of that sort.
One natural question is whether, I'm just not aware, whether the publications somehow subsidize the rest, or the rest subsidizes the publications.
There has been over recent years a relatively small positive side from the publications, along with a somewhat larger income from the APS. Look, the APS is a healthy organization at the moment financially. It's got reserves in the bank, sort of invested, of about $50 million, just sort of roughly order of magnitude. And it's built that up over the last decade or so, just by adding a little bit every year, and the income on that is probably a bigger chunk. That's what, in fact, gives the a positive balance to what's going on these days. The publication is just about a wash at the moment. It was for some years a small plus. Okay. It certainly is not the. I know this is an item of concern, so let me say it is not the cash cow for the APS. Certainly not at the moment. In fact, and there's a point that we could get to later on. The APS could make a lot. If the APS ran its operation or possibly turned it over to a commercial publishing company, it would do it would do a lot better, or the commercial publishing company would do a lot better, I would guess, for 3 years, and then the library system in the United States would collapse. It's a very serious set of issues that I'd like to spend some time on. Gary?
Do you know roughly what fraction, in terms of the income that the publications bring in, what fraction is from subscriptions and what fraction is from page charges?
Well, the page charges are essentially out already. That we're going completely out of the business of page charges. Another interesting question. So the income comes from subscriptions, and of course those are not member subscriptions, those are libraries. And that's the situation that is considered pretty tough. Although the APS, I think even compared to other professional societies, the APS journals per page are much cheaper for the libraries, but by factors of 3 or 4, at least, sometimes 10. Maybe I should be off the record on that. It's still going on. Gordon and Breach has been suing the American Physical Society all over the world, and has by and large lost at great legal expense to the American Physical Society, because the American Physical Society published an article in, I think, in Physics, was it coming out in Physics Today, I think, some 10 years ago at least, that compared the not just the per page charges, but then the impact, the citations to papers appearing in the Physical Review, to papers appearing in these commercial journals, they were attacked as publishing false advertising or something like that. But the numbers, so far as I know, stand. It was the legalities, or whether you were allowed to say it in public if you were the publisher. Let's get back to that, because it's a big issue. Let me just make sure that people understand what's going on in the last few years about the what I call the health of this profession. What's clearly the case now, and it wasn't the case when I was a kid, is that the physics community in the United States has to be as outspoken as any other special interest group about it getting its share of public support on which it depends. If you don't play the game, you don't get the attention of people in Congress. And that's it. The American Physical Society is now a registered lobbying organization. And in fact, in the last several years, has been the national leader in an effort to bring. Well, it's now got a statement to Congress, to the President, that keeps on pushing in various kinds of testimony, people signing letters and things like that, insisting on the long-term value of investments in fundamental research in the United States. And there are some 104, I think, professional scientific and engineering societies that have signed on to this. They represent something like 3 million scientists and engineers. And when you get that size together, I mean, that's about twice as big as the Christian Coalition, I think. And when you get that size together, you get people to notice you. Whether it's doing any good yet or not, nobody knows. It probably helped the NSF not take a big cut last year. It certainly is a large part of the reason that there is a bill that's making its way through the Senate, originated by the unlikely combination of Phil Gramm and Lieberman, a sort of a bipartisan effort to try to get increased funding for basic research in this country. And at least the president and other people are paying lip service to it. This was largely an effort that started with the American Physical Society. Alan Bromley was the president of the Physical Society last year. And in case you don't know, this is the same Bromley who was the author of the Bromley Report, which in the early 70s was, I guess it's the first of the big decadal studies by the National Academy, National Research Council, of the state of physics in the country. And then he was the science advisor and the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy under President Bush, which gives him enormous kinds of contact, the like of which I could not imagine myself having, unfortunately, and I have to ride his coattails, although I come from the opposite side of the political spectrum, more or less. It's an interesting situation. It was he who got this whole business going. And in fact, it's going very well now. The Physical Society has a full-time office with, I think, three people in Washington whose job it is to know what's going on in congressional committees, to talk to the committee staff, to bring things back, to understand where the political lobbying efforts have to be made. They were very helpful. I made a trip last spring before I was conjunction just with the Division of Condensed Matter Physics, visiting congressional offices, talking to people, talking to staff. The fact that you're there makes a big difference. And so this kind of thing is going on very actively. It's not just the political lobbying there. There's also, in the hands of Bob Park, you may notice, a very active effort to try to counteract some of the voodoo science that's going on so much in this country. Whether we're the boy with the, we're not even have a finger in the dike, or I think we're considerably less than that when you understand what's happening there. But again, it's the kind of activity that has to go on and somehow has to be enlarged. There's a lot of activity, much more than there used to be. Not only in politics, but in education, and in also the sort of the job situation, a great deal of effort, both in especially in education. At first, I thought this was just going to be a drop in the bucket, but in fact, it can have there are certain kinds of activities that you can do that do have some leverage. For example, one of the big problems nationally is that physics departments are losing undergraduate majors, So one of the efforts is to try to get the departments that have successful ways of counteracting those trends to help other people learn what kinds of things are effective. And also, there's a considerable amount of effort of trying to establish and help physics departments around the country do the kinds of things that we're doing here, the outreach to local high schools like local elementary schools that makes both physics education possibly a little bit better and makes the image of physics nationally a bit better, which goes back to the political support and also goes back to the question about whether kids are going to be interested in thinking about careers in that subject. I just signed an angry letter this weekend to the California education people because they're about to put some completely crazy standards for K-12 science education through in the state, which would then determine what all the textbook writers have to write, which would then determine, because California is so big, would determine what goes on around the country. We'll probably lose that one, but nevertheless, it's the kind of issue that you need some people to be active on, and if we can help a little bit on that, all the better. What?
What's ridiculous?
Oh, well, instead of, there have been a number of agencies, including the academy in the country, that have actually drawn up some fairly reasonable standards that, and in fact, if you look at it, sort of address some of the only serious ideas that anybody has about why American students do so badly compared to other countries in elementary and high school level physics in particular, mathematics and physics. You look at the textbooks and they're full of facts and they're very thick and everybody basically is told to memorize a whole lot of stuff and never try to understand it and with also a lack of continuity. And there's also a very complex issue, this was apparently in the hands of some people that wanted the fifth graders to be memorizing the symbols for all the elements in the periodic table and stuff like that. And I didn't understand who was on the right side of that fight. I think I've learned a little bit more about that recently. But that's another big issue that I'm not confident. In any case, look, you need some organization to keep its eye on that kind of stuff and where possible to pay attention to it. So it's this kind of thing that in fact engages the Physical Society today in a way that Hans Bethe had never dreamed of. Maybe he did. Hans, of course, could have dreamed of anything sensible. But certainly I didn't dream of 20 years ago that there is a need for a professional organization to be paying attention to. It goes. It sometimes doesn't go all that smoothly. It happens, and I think it's happening better now than it was just a few years ago. Any other questions along these lines, or because I know most people really want to talk about publications.
Oh, yeah, I mean. Among what I would consider this heading, the ATS has been pretty much of a leader in the issue of figuring out how physics departments can be more hospitable to women and minorities.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I belong to the ATS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a.
That's been a real sort of leadership effort among science disciplines in the country. There have been other organizations which have modeled their approach on the basis of what the Committee on the Status of Women
has. That's right.
There's a visit with various physics departments.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of other things like that under that heading
Thank you, Amanda. I probably should have put that that up from the beginning. It clearly is an important thing.
How is it actually organized in the ATS? Is there like a committee of a few people?
Oh, there's a committee on education, but there's also there's some permanent staff. The person in charge of this is a I think he's a plasma physicist, but he's doing this, at least half time, maybe three quarters time, Ramon Lopez. I have a very good impression of him. In fact, it was he who got himself involved in the debate in California, bringing some other people into it, like Helen Quinn. That's how we knew precisely what was going on about this. His other kinds of activities are organizing teachers' days at large meetings. I spent a morning in Los Angeles with a bunch of local Los Angeles area high school teachers and talked to them about the physics that I was doing, and then listened to the kinds of stuff that they were doing, and they had put up a poster exhibit on their area-wide project, which has had some help and certainly some cheerleading from the American Physical Society. There's something that is always a source of confusion, is that the APS is one, significantly the biggest, but it's only one of a whole set of physics societies that come under the heading of the American Institute of Physics. So there's the American Association of Physics Teachers, and the APS works directly with them. In fact, the statement that I signed off on is a joint statement coming from the APS and the AAPT. But there's also the American Optical Society, American Vacuum Society, the American Acoustical Society. There's the American Geophysical Union, which is the second biggest thing that appears there. I think I'm the only to be president of the American Physical Society who has ever published in the Journal of Geophysical Research. that's another story that you would be amused about, especially when we get to this part of the subject. Other comments or yeah?
About the health of the profession, but it is known that 1,400 PhDs are granted in the United States a year.
Yeah.
At the same time, about 400 people are hired by the colleges and two-year colleges. So all the rest, so most of the physicists are finding jobs elsewhere in the industry. And at the same time, it seems to me that APS focuses exclusively on the academia, and doesn't help the physicists in other parts. So being a member of the APS could suggest a direction that the APS should do the public relations, and to in order to represent physicists not as a bunch of wackos thinking about wormholes in the space, but as people can do semiconductors, lasers, superconductors, and so forth.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true, it's something that is very much on my mind and the mind of lots of other people, because it's a dramatic trend. You see that, in fact, you quote these statistics about the production of PhDs. The fact of the matter is that in the last year, the job situation, knock on wood, because these things are going to continue to fluctuate, the job situation's turned around dramatically. There were sort of an overflow of people, employers, trying to interview new PhDs at the March meeting, the Physical Society. You can see it anecdotally about the number of jobs that seem to be available, but a very large fraction of these jobs now are in industry. More and more physicists are finding careers in applied physics and industrial kinds of things, and the Physical Society, the industrial physicists make up, I don't know exactly what the number is, but at least something like half, maybe even more than a majority of the membership in the APS. There's no doubt that we're going to be paying a lot more attention to the health of that part of the profession, both making sure that we're responding in our meetings to things that they're interested in the encouraging the physics departments to be preparing people more adequately for careers not in academia but in industry. It's not an easy thing to do. Because I mean, I don't.
The APS has done some things to react to the situation. I mean, to say that the APS does nothing about it is not to be quite honest.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been various career things that have been held in various meetings that have been incredibly popular.
Yeah.
I could mention a number of other initiatives. I mean, for example, I think it was the AIP in conjunction with the APS that surveyed 1994 graduates, for example, have been following people asking where they're.
That's right. We're trying to
every
keep statistics.
Every year I'm just getting
a lot. A lot of that, though, is in fact done by the AIP, and the AIP does not always do what the APS leadership tells it to do. there's another very interesting. The AIP publishes Physics Today, and in what I consider a mistake. Related just to this question, they decided, well, we have to serve the industrial physicists better, so they decided instead of really reorienting a lot of the stuff in Physics Today, they would publish a separate journal called the Industrial Physicists. And indeed, it has a different flavor. It has some stuff that's rather interesting, some stuff that I'm not quite so happy with, but I think that was. If I had had my druthers, I think I would have said, no, you have to really change Physics Today rather than increase the split. That's the kind of thing that happens. Yeah, Steve?
I just wondered, well, back on the general question, how does the profession, to what extent the APS is. Made organized efforts to educate both its members and other physicists who aren't members about what they're doing in the theory. Because some of this comes as, we're not aware of it. And that's sort of what you're doing.
Okay.
Here, are there organized, to what extent?
Well, how do you reach people that aren't members of the APS, that's hard. The APS, if you belong to the APS, you get Physics Today, of course, but you also get the APS news, which comes fairly regularly and has a whole lot of this stuff in it.
The APS hasn't done much recruiting on membership. I mean, newspapers matter. It's no problem finding out about it.
Yeah.
I don't think the APS has done this partly because they haven't had the need to, or they're unaware of the problem that came up. And this would be cheap and would bring a lot of benefit.
My guess is that lots of people in the organization were not aware of the problem. But remember, until very recently, and most people in the organization didn't think that you could just do all your research via the Los Alamos archives. It's coming. But if you think it's a revelation to the old thugs of the APS, you should talk to the people at the American Geophysical Union.
How much of academia that the university faculty member or of physics department are actually members?
I don't know the answer to that. My impression is that at least until recently, a rather large fraction, and that was probably why it wasn't. I don't know, David. I think I'm going to ask that. Yeah.
Who are not members?
Yeah.
Not
members.
VP-elect is looking for your check.
Look, we discovered at the March meeting, because they improved, except for the fact that the computer crashed during registration, but there was an improved the computer program that could detect which people were registering and going to pay members rates who were not actually members of the society, and I think we had 600 new membership applications.
How many people have never been to an ABS meeting?
Yeah.
Never.
Well, and in fact, again, the culture in theoretical physics, especially particle theory, has been for a generation at least that the meetings that you go to are just not, haven't been the APS meetings. So these are situations that develop, are partly historical, partly, you know, it's like a restaurant. If the chef is out one night and the food is lousy, you never come back. You don't have any connection with it. But it's also partly a sense of what community do you identify with, and which of your interests are being represented by a certain community, and which things do you know you depend on that might be done by particular organizations. And as I say, look, I was always a member because I came into physics early enough when you could still actually subscribe to the Physical Review. And of course, nobody does that anymore. I didn't do it for very long. And the green monster would have been out of my office very shortly. But you know, you keep up the membership and then things go on. Steve.
It's a little embarrassing to say this, but as long as we're talking about membership, I have to say that I never considered being a member until my colleagues pointed out that it was the best way to get cheap life insurance.
The point is that I'm pretty well convinced that we need, a community needs this sort of effort, these days, and in fact, we could completely solve probably the problems that we're facing down here with the simple expedient of getting all the practicing physicists in the country to be members of the American Physical Society. It would probably raise the dues. And I don't know for sure whether those numbers are at all right, but it would certainly be a big help. Cliff?
Crucial to the health of the profession, in my mind, is also informing non-physicists what physicists are doing.
Precisely.
What component of organized effort is in
that? Well, that's... comes under here for one thing,
but
particularly.
Didn't really sort of break it down.
Well, for example, one of the big jobs that is being done by the political office is working with people, both the scientists and newspapers and publications, to get things like op-ed articles published that talk about what the physicists are doing, and indeed, a couple weeks ago now, there was an op-ed article in the Chicago Tribune by Leon Letterman pointing out that he didn't want to start smoking in order to be paying to support physics, that we really all ought to get on the bandwagon and support the Senate bill for a much more sensible investment in research in the country. And indeed, whether it's cause and effect or not, that generated, we know, a whole lot of telephone calls to one of the Illinois senators who had not signed on, I forget the name, as a co-sponsor of that bill, and the signature is now there. It's those kinds of things that help, and they go back through the community. Let's talk.
Just to follow up, that office in Washington, which you pointed out, are they the people also who are responsible for PBS shows, that kind of thing?
They're not the only people that are responsible for it. In fact, look, one of the things that I should tell you is that 1999 is the 100th anniversary of the American Physical Society. And there's going to be a big centennial celebration. It's a combined March and April meetings next March, March 1999, in Atlanta, this great big conference center in Atlanta. And one of the things that the society has done is it's taken on, with a little bit of awkwardness, the services of a public relations firm for precisely the things that Cliff is talking about, with the idea of trying to get out into not just the Science Times, but in the other pages of local newspapers, just plenty of articles about what physics really does. There are a number of such things happening. The NRC, by the way, has a nice booklet that I was involved in on the impact of condensed matter and materials physics, which is being circulated. In fact, it's going to go to not only colleges, but I think high schools and certainly government offices and stuff like that. Simply pointing out that essentially everything around us comes from relatively recent research in modern physics. The lasers, the transistors, the medical devices. Okay, look, this I think is the big question. And one thing that probably most of you don't know is that there has been a major change in the publication philosophy brought about by bringing in a new editor-in-chief, namely Marty Bloom. And probably this community doesn't know Marty, but he's an old friend of mine. He was for some years the deputy director of Brookhaven, he's a condensed matter theorist, but by being deputy director of Brookhaven, he got a pretty broad understanding of what was going on. He's a person with a good deal of sense about both history and where we're going on these things. And he immediately realized that the Physical Society is in the business of communicating, that its interest is in help making it as easy as possible for good papers to be published and for people who are going to use that material to have access to it. So all of a sudden, number one, there are, I told you already, and this goes back a little bit before, there are not going to be page charges for American Physical Society journals at all. I was a bit surprised by that, but it's true, is that it was a definite barrier to lots of communities, in particular the nuclear and particle experimental communities, for publishing in APS journals. But much more important than that, there is essentially, everything is going to become electronic. There's an interesting question of how you pay for it. I guess I'm allowed to call it in public a peace treaty signed between the American Physical Society and Paul Ginsberg. Unlike most other journals around the country, you could now write an article in Physical Review and cite the archive number on the Los Alamos archive. You will be able, in fact, when this whole thing gets through, to take the online version of an article and click on that and get to the Los Alamos archive and backwards and forwards. Now, there are, in addition to the current publications being online, there is another project called Physical Review Online Archives, and they're back to 1985. Actually, this is not generally, there's no general access to it, but I know the secret number, and I haven't tried it yet, so I can find out what it looks like. And if anybody's really curious to explore that with me, it's still in progress, but it's going to be generally available with some financial aspects to be decided within the next, it's a matter of months, not years. It's back to 1985 now, which I believe is about half of all the material that's ever been published in the Physical Review. Okay. Now, what? I think so, yeah. But
so you'll have to subscribe to this?
Well, probably if you are a card-carrying member of a physics department at a university whose library buys the whole subscription, you are automatically have access.
There is this,
but that's a little bit...
the Astrophysical Journal is online for free.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it. There's someone got a grant and scanning.
Well, a lot of that is maybe lost leader, too. In other words, because eventually people have to figure out how to pay for it.
Well, but it's a bit of a one-shot deal. Just hand it in, and then there.
Yeah, except that if everybody reads the journal and nobody pays for it, then there's a... What? The old journals?
Yeah,
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, the fees for getting access will probably be minimal, but because it is not a... it's not going to be a costly kind of thing. Except, yes, Sandy?
This comment about who had access to the old ISREB online, it strikes me that's an area where you are being discriminatory to industrial laboratories and other areas, because they would never subscribe to the whole ISREB.
No.
So
well, but the point is that the access to what's called PROLA is presumably going to be something that you as an individual could get to, you know, for a reasonable cost, and presumably a site license but that's the whole point, is that the numbers of papers being published, by the way, are still, it's still growing, I think still exponentially. The fact is that the Physical Review is, again, by probably an order of magnitude bigger than any other journal and in physics, and over 70% of all the submissions come from outside the United States and Canada. Now, it's become an international journal, and 70%, yeah. The percentage from within the United States of submissions is about 28% now, and the percentage of, you know, there's a slight bias, but not much, of publications is about 30%. So it's an absolutely remarkable figure, and of course, again, emphasizing this question of whose responsibility is it to, you know, to pay for the costs of this kind of thing. Now, Amanda, you want to ask?
I was going to mention that some places that can't necessarily afford to get the journal would be very pleased to be able to access it online.
Yeah.
Some universities in New Zealand can't.
Yeah, yeah.
You cannot look up various versions of the Physical Review because they just couldn't afford it.
Yeah, but
it has to be affordable to
sure.
Like that as well.
Yeah, and that's where the big question is.
Small universities in the United States, whose library budget for the first thing to get cut whenever there's
Look, let me give you. I do know some approximate figures. There is that about. I think it's almost two-thirds of the subscriptions to Physical Review come from abroad. And of the one-third, maybe a little bit more than a third, that are within the United States, half of those, only half, are from what we would call research universities. The other half are from smaller places that are having trouble. The subscriptions to Physical Review have been going down by about 3% a year in numbers of subscriptions, but that's not recent. That's since 1970. It's an almost steady decline since 1970 at about 3% a year. There's a system, piece of the system there that just isn't going to be quite sustainable. Yeah, Steve?
I guess a deeper question on the publication issue is what is the sort of value added of Physical Review? The archival material is, you know, would be very useful to have online, but the working high-energy theorist for string theorists today is going to spring.
Okay, that's the issue that I really wanted to discuss.
Yeah.
And let me phrase it slightly differently, Steve. The question is, what the hell do you need a peer-reviewed journal for? Right? Because the costs of doing this are almost entirely I mean, look, there's a certain amount of hardware, there's paper, there's postage, which you're probably going to get out of mostly. But the real costs are maintaining an editorial staff and going through all of this business of deciding what gets in, how it's mounted, and particularly what gets in. And so the question becomes, now, is there any need? Couldn't we just for the foreseeable future live on the Los Alamos archive, let anybody post whatever he or she wants to post, have unlimited free access, and will research, in fact, go ahead like that profitably forever? And I see this as a very serious question. I don't think the answer is completely obvious. I think the answer is that we can't do that. But I, for example, I do not. There's a standard answer that librarians will give you about why do you need refereed journals or controlled literature like that, and they'll say, well, if we didn't have that, how would the dean know whom to promote? if in fact you cut out refereeing just now, there are a lot of young people in the room who would have a little bit of trouble. But I'm pretty sure we could figure out a way of getting around that problem. I think that the more serious answer has to do with is that Phil back there? Let me just finish the sentence and I'll get you. You're in a silhouette with the window behind you. The more serious answer has to do with thinking about your corner of the field 10 years down the line when, in fact, it might need to stretch out a little bit. The kind of research that I and mostly my junior associates do, we actually look in literature, in the engineering literature, in the mathematics literature. We sometimes go back, my goodness, not just 5 years, but 20 or 30, because there are things that were written that we need access to. Basically, we need a somewhat regulated, certainly searchable, but with some sense that there is some level of quality control. Doesn't necessarily, no quality control is going to regularly keep out all of the crap, or even accept all of the really good stuff. Although you'd hope that you could arrange that would.
It's a usual argument that when you're not an expert, you want to be able to look at something and know.
That's right. That is not by any means a reliable way of getting to reasonable stuff.
In fact, a lot of the problems you're talking about are problems that are most easily cured by the kind of linkage, cross linkage, that could be set up within a
time. Well, who's going to organize that, David?
People tend to do this spontaneously. For various reasons, or it answers to certain needs.
But
somebody trying to establish a field or create such a connection would be motivated to do that
or would the difficulty of doing that be a strong disincentive to try to start a new field? We're already seeing things like that. Phil, did you have a hand up here?
Well, I think this question is actually a really important one beyond simply the context of the people and the other journals. But can you imagine, for example, if you were required to read peer-reviewed newspapers, peer-reviewed books? It's really more of a censorship issue than anything, and although we like to talk peer-reviewed, it's kind of intellectual censorship. And my suspicion is that the quality would really not drop very much at all by the way of the peer review. Because the people that were your peers are reviewing it by reading it. And if they want to know, is this person doing good work, they write for the letters of recommendation rather than count the number of peer reviewed publications.
All right, I think you.
We have experience with this already, and the telepoint is clearly proven.
That's except. Okay, but I want you to think about a rather different scenario. Somebody ultimately is going to control the literature. What I mean.
Bill Gates.
Sure, exactly. It isn't going to last for indefinitely long with one server and one workstation at Los Alamos.
No, there are many mirrors.
Bill
Gates backs down Los Alamos.
Look, the real alternative to the evolution of the present system is something that people are very worried about. Is that somebody is going to own this communication system. At the moment, the commercial publishing houses would love to own it. They would love to buy, I suspect, the physical review. It would be a terrific investment.
I think it would be a terrible investment because it will cease to exist.
Oh, but they could get their profit out long before it ceases to exist.
What? People will just abandon it.
I mean, there was one point which has not been brought up here, but I think historically the reason for professional societies and veterinary journals, and it had to do with secrecy versus priority, And the main function of journals, I mean, before people had journals, they were books, and they published their own stuff. It took 5 years, and it was hard to circulate. People could steal, they wrote anagramic formulas, discoveries, come back 10 years later and put them on But the main issue was priority and possession, ownership, as you said. And referee journals, I thought, historically rose in order to make possible open dissemination of information, protect people, give them copies, ownership. Discovery, so what was important was publication date, when it came in, and so on and so on. That started eroding, actually, that function of the journal started eroding long before the electronic thing. Again, in our field, because we're very rapidly moving field, by preprints.
Preprints, yeah.
People started circulating preprints, and nobody read the journals anymore, starting in the 70s, actually, publication, because by the time the journal came out, it was passé. It was already read the preprints. That was very anti-democratic. Very people got all the preprints. You had to be famous to get everything. So it was very discriminatory in our work. But it, people learned to trust sending out preprints in our field without having it published. And there are many other fields that still don't do that. Mathematics, some areas, they won't really send out preprints except maybe to a few close friends before the thing is in publication. What we learned in particle physics, especially, and then gradually in the other parts of physics, that this did not threaten in any serious way priority. It accelerated the development of the field. And the electronic thing actually has promoted this even more because now, everyone in the world. Whatever comes out, the day after it comes out, can't.
But David, there's no debate about that.
So,
it's
not clear to me that these other things, reasons given for the existence of journals, are really of any validity. Anything else except that one thing. We don't need it really for deciding who's going to get tenure and who isn't, because we can actually go by content. We don't need it for our
cargo
firm. We don't need it to
have a. It's hard, harder than he says. But look, I maintain, and I'll come back to the.
I'm laughing at this because the sheer number of papers that are being published is just for that reason. Literature is so huge.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many people around who need promotion. So they publish even, you know, mediocre papers, but they push them through.
Yeah. But look. They
have increased the number of papers being published,
yeah,
which is perhaps unfortunate. So there are some bad effects of the, what's going on now that nobody talks about, nobody's talking about. One thing I think we've all noticed in our community is that publication becomes so easy that people publish very quickly. But they used to in the old days too.
Oh yeah, yeah. Look, Einstein was sending off one short thing to Zeitschrift für Physik, or the Annalen der Physik, I guess.
It would
come out in 3 weeks, and then he'd write again and say, oh, I was wrong. But look, I maintain, and I really don't want to back off this point, because I think you need to think about it, that especially the string theory community here, you're a relatively small, highly focused community going off in your own direction at the moment, reinforcing each other in a very effective way, and from what I understand, it's absolutely beautiful and absolutely essential. That's another discussion that David and I think of having at this one of these lunch meetings. But that is not typical of the kind of scholarship that science is going to has had in the past or ought to be looking forward to in the future. What we have to think about, especially for the future, is that what we're doing now is going to end up being broadly interesting to kinds of other kinds of scientists that we can't even guess, we can't even predict. And that what you see with, I'm suggesting, blinders on, is a very special circumstance that may be fine now and may indeed, in fact, is indeed a wonderful feature of the way we can do research with using modern technology. It is not the whole story about what scientific scholarship is or will be. And that if indeed we're going to maintain the sort of broader picture of a broadly interactive scientific community, that scientific community needs some degree of a literature with some degree of modulation or moderation, with some selectivity, so that it doesn't get completely swamped with crap, and so that we can go across and find out what's happening. Now let's try to. I've got lots of hands up. Let's see. I think Tommy had your hand first.
I think there are two reasons here. I've had endless debates about the question of whether we need refereeing or not. And I think, it's not a question of that, I really think. But I think what's come out of discussions, particularly with Ginsburg, is that it's possible to create a refereeing system as an overlay on the existing archives, in which the additional overhead and the organizational costs will really be quite small compared to what they are today, because you won't have any extra publication. What the journal will consist of is a page saying these are the articles on the archives that are approved and have been refereed by the august body that runs the physical review, and that's it. And
that may
the archives will have markers in them saying this paper is a physical review paper, and that's all we need. And it cuts down on the cost of publication.
That may be where we're headed. Remember, look. So far as I'm concerned, and I'm just talking for myself, I don't give a damn whether the publications is $25 million in and $25 million out, or $10,000 in and $10,000 out. It doesn't make any difference to the American Physical Society. Of course, the value added to the major...
According to Paul, it apparently did, at least for a long time, because he suggested this years ago.
Oh, come on. He suggested it to a series of editors who were thinking like librarians. The standard librarian...
We've encountered the same thing with conferences.
Yeah.
People like to
use these volumes. Oh, yeah. Well, look, and if you're a real dyed-in-the-wool librarian, what you like to do is you like to see everything that's in your library there and never taken out. and if you're a dyed-in-the-wool old sort of editor, you want to see all the publications in hardcover lined up and and everybody exactly in the same format and you know, so and you know it looks prettier that way, but there it's not at all clear what the value added is. But the bottom line, and let me repeat it, is that we want to keep the control of the literature in the hands of a professional society. We don't want it to be Bill Gates. We don't want it to be Springer. We certainly don't want it to be Gordon and Breach. We want to keep the control of the literature and preferably a literature that is maximally useful for a broad range, as broad as possible, a range of scientists for as long as possible into the future. Okay? And we want it to be in the hands of the scientific community. We don't want it to go into private enterprise. Gary.
Yeah, so I guess two comments about this sort of issue of controlling the literature. I mean, you can ask what fraction of papers that are submitted eventually get published in a FISREV.
Oh, FISREV?
And I think the number is close to 50% or
no, it's in the ordinary FISREV A through E, it's somewhere between 65% and 70% now.
70% of papers that actually get published.
That's right. And in physical review letters, it's about 40%. What?
I mean, I personally would be much, happier to sort of not spend any money and not spend all the effort. I mean, as a referee, I would have thought referees, the main cost is the labor of getting people to read the papers and decide
That's exactly, and that's one of the big things that the professional society brings to the operation.
But the thing is that with all that effort, your net result is just cutting out maybe
30%. No! Wait a minute! How many people? how many crackpots? Or how many people just think twice, even if they're not crackpots, before sending the fact that it's a referee journal. It makes a big difference. I'm not sure that this is going to. It's very hard, and because of the degree of self-selection and the degree of uncertainty. The fact of the matter is that for a while, and I'm not sure that this is still going to be true. FISREV has been trying to cut down the acceptance rate in order to minimize, to decrease the number of published pages, I'm not convinced that now, after having looked at it, is a sensible way to go. If what's coming in is good stuff, and as is increasingly because of this internationalization of the journal, then I think what we'd want to do is figure out what the best way of getting it. Is, and indeed, that's another thing that I've been very pleased at, and I've been pushing personally myself, is that the editors of Physical Review ought to be sort of acting as if they're in a competitive industry. It's in their interest to have the best papers published, and not to make mistakes, especially at the at the upper end, and that they should be acting in a way to attract authors rather than the other way around. Let's see, I better go to...
The main argument you seem to want to make for the relevance of referee journals is the value for people who are not experts in the field.
Or are not in the in-group at the moment,
yeah. Who are not in the in-group at the moment. Yeah. But my objection to that is basically related to what Gary is saying, which is that I don't think referee journals do a particularly good job of providing added value for people who are not in the in-group at the moment. I mean, Physical Review Letters is the journal which is supposed to do this the most for people who are really in a wide range of interests. And I don't think I know anybody who's read an entire issue of Physical Review Letters.
Look, again, Physical Review Letters has been sort of pushed out of that mold, and it admits it.
Do you read the New York Times all the way through every day?
Yeah.
Or whatever newspaper you get.
Yeah. But look, I do find, I personally find that, you know, I continue to have a print subscription to PhysRev Letters because I, you know, I can't take the my computer into the facilities with me. but I, you know, every issue I find you know, a few things that, that I'm interested in. I can't do that with PhysRev B anymore. You know, the fraction of the stuff that I'm really interested in reading. I need somebody to archive that for me. And by the way, that's the other the other comment there is that it's not just for today's readers. I mean, what you're hoping is that some, you know, non-trivial fraction of what gets into physical review today will still be interesting, say, even 10 years from now, as used as a reference. And you want somebody responsible for making it continue to develop.
A referee journal does a significantly better job of providing information in the format that's going to be useful 10 years from now than the archives do.
But compare... Oh, sorry. Okay.
The book form is the most durable through history. What are you going to have maybe in 20 years? You're going to have a completely different 20 years, 3 years, a completely different technology. Both for, I mean, whenever you use the electronic journal, what do you really do? You print it out.
No.
That's what you find the
I don't
need
it on the computer screen. You don't need to print it out, but the main thing
that
China Journal has over paper journal is cross-legged and search
pattern. And that's fine, what I'm saying.
So there's no question in my mind that any of us, we can do a poll again. I mean, don't go to libraries anymore. Mm-hmm. Anything that exists on the net, you can find in a minute.
If you really want to study something, something you want to go through in detail and get the equations out, you print it out. That's not. Yeah, the point. He's making a different point. What he's saying is that at least at the moment, there's a serious technical question. Namely, you know, I can put the current issue of physical review on a disk. And stick it away somewhere. And the question is, 3 years from now, will the computer that I'm using have the facility for reading that disk? Indeed, that's one of the functions that has to be done here is archiving. You know, certainly archiving in print is probably a good idea, but who knows whether you need more than three copies. Making sure that the archive material on whatever disks and in whatever code is being used now is then updated so that it can be read by the machines 10 years from now. It is a very important responsibility, and somebody needs to do that.
You should not get rid of the print version.
No.
The electronic version should not supplant the print version totally. That in future there will be articles for which no archive. Print version exists. It's the only way you get it is from the.
It's clearly an alternative to that. That is to make it the commitment to updating the.
Okay,
how big is it going to be to update the technology?
That translates back into.
Well,
what if you have to do it every 6 months?
Okay, look. Okay. It's an interesting issue, but look, we're going to have to quit pretty soon. Let's see. Natan had something and then. Yeah.
No, I know.
An experiment.
Yeah.
It seems to me there's a lot of controversy about just the community. It seems to me that probably we should get most of the particle theorists to agree that what we should do with physical review D is to turn it into a web page, an overlay on the Los Alamos archive, and just physical review D, do it as an experiment. I'd like it to be better than the other electronic journals.
Look,
it doesn't have to be in LaTeX.
I'm not quite sure what needs to be done. All the physical review D is doing now is it's going through the business of refereeing. As soon as a paper is accepted in D now, it goes up on the APS page.
But why do you need all of the? Just eliminate the printing of physical review papers.
I think that this is one of the options that the Physical Society is going to provide for libraries.
Partial experiment, which is starting an idea, that not to be done broadly.
Well,
take one field which sort of leads in this effort and try it out there.
Well, look, let me tell you another experiment that just got started. It has particular relevance to Physical Review D, is that the American Physical Society is starting a completely electronic journal on particles and accelerators and beam physics. There's going to be no hard copy. It'll be refereed. Open access, and at the moment it's being funded, because it requires some money to keep that going, it's being funded by some contributions from several of the accelerator labs. The editor is Bob Siemens from Stanford. If that works, it's fine. But look, there's a bunch of other experiments going on around the world. The British Physical Society and the Germans are getting together with another all-electronic physics journal that will be free to everybody, and it's going to be funded by page charges, they think.
The OSA already has an all
the Optical Society of
America. The Express Journal is all online.
That's all, yeah. Yeah. Tony?
Well, I think before we decide to abandon print completely, in my area, we should try to bear in mind that there are still parts of the world which don't have
For
example, in India, it's quite clear that people would rather get rid of having to pay yearly subscription to expensive journals. Because you just have to put up a PC and a connection to.
Yeah. The electronic mechanism is very much more democratic, and I think it's a very wonderful thing about it. Last few comments. Alex,
I'd like to hear the discussion about the refereeing. Most people in this room seem to be discussing the possibility for added value altogether. I'd like to put to you that there is that value. I'd like to hear what other scientists think about publication.
Yeah, Alex and I just submitted a paper which came back with some negative reports from a referee who clearly had not read past page 3. And we were very angry, of course, and then we realized that we had forgotten to say something crucial on page 2.
You can also subtract value, right? I mean, there are examples of papers that appear in FISREV letters that then appear the next day in some page in the New York Times, even though they were not correct. And the reason why they would appear in some page in the New York Times is because they appeared in FISREV letters, so that to the non-scientist, they
come on. There's no way of guarding against mistakes, but I think Alex's point is right. Is that I've had any number of cases where a referee has improved my papers.
I think in the archives you get exactly the same effect. You put out a paper. If there's something wrong with it, you hear about it very quickly.
It's only if it's interesting,
and
which is a good thing.
You put out a revised version, and it all gets done with.
Okay, but that's let's see. Phil, you and then.
It's like a referee, but
look, I have to. Phil?
Just one quick comment. The entire astronomical community publishes on astrophysics these days. They don't bother. Not that they don't bother. As an afterthought, they say, well, I better submit to astrophysical journals because I need to quote something in my resume. But that's the real thing. But virtually the experiment's already been in progress for several years. Mm-hmm. You don't see it overrun with craft, except the craft that gets published. Another issue,
completely separate issue. But it's very easy to have a minimal gate where you say, I'm going to keep out, you know, stuff that's just really completely unreasonable. And we have to define what unreasonable is. But it's very easy to do that unless through the rest. I think it's clear it does work because we already have examples.
Tony and I.
These have been taken in much of the discussion about the refereeing system. The main function of the refereeing system is to keep out material which is wrong. But we should also remember that it's a big function to keep out or improve material which is badly written. And I actually, as a referee, spent weeks of time doing this, keeping out ideas like this. In fact, I would never reject a paper simply on the ground that I did not read. I would reject it. I'd be shocked if it's written so bad.
I think that, again, the communities where the communication is tight within small groups, and Phil, that includes what you're saying, where you know what everybody is saying, what you're losing is, again, this business of thinking, 5-10 years down the line, is there going to be a body of literature that is accessible and understandable and reasonably reliable.
I mean, as far as the present discussion, I mean, particle physics is acceptable for me, I think, as well, but there are other new modes of publishing which are possible, which require really more of an institutional investment, which I don't think are being talked about as much. For example, I know I would like to be able to easily get videotapes of the great colloquiums of the physicists in colloquiums. And there is no institutional mechanism for publishing. Universities do have the facility to make a videotape of such a person, but what do they do with it? Once it's on the shelf. But there are many sort of new forms of publishing that could be started that would require institutional resources to
develop. Well, the ITP is doing that.
Yeah. The ITP is doing it, and fairly soon it will be possible to do that on the web. To get the equivalent of videotapes. And in fact, we're already seeing people, the electronic versions of some papers will actually have you click on it, and you can get a little a movie that shows what's going on. We'll settle a few more. That's on you.
I would like to ask, what are the alternatives to refereeing? I think one of the alternatives that's not being sufficiently promoted now is writing reviews. Too few reviews are being written in many fields. I don't know if it applies to all fields.
Yeah.
And I think that the society could perhaps find ways of encouraging the writing of reviews, because I think the same reasons that encourage the literature to be so large, namely to promote people later on, is the same thing that's not encouraging to write reviews. Person writing a review gets very little credit for it down the line.
Yeah. So what we need are more summer schools with published proceedings.
No. I mean, the reviews of modern physics is the only thing I still subscribe to, because it's still okay. And
but
that journal depends a lot on the editor. I mean, when that journal has good editor.
Yeah. At the moment,
really went down.
Yeah.
But there should, it does require, I think, something like the community in an official way to give some extra recognition to people who are willing to do all that work for them.
Yeah.
And
I think this is a better way of fulfilling the admirable goal of providing something which will be of use to people 5 or 10 years down the road who are not part of the in-group.
I mean, one thing is the American Physical Society has an organization, which nobody else can really do, could pay for something like that, could use some of its funds to actually go out and solicit and pay people enough so that they would feel they were getting some, a reasonable return for what is a lot of work.
Yeah.
$10,000 to have a really good review of string theory wouldn't be bad.
It's so much the money.
An hour?
I think that would work out to a penny an hour.
It's not the issue of money, it's the issue of credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the time that
I'm saying. The honor. I mean, people used to be that writing reviews was a very honored and recognized contribution. And there's some famous ones, Bader, just founded the field. People don't do that.
Okay, Cliff, the last one.
Very brief thing, not forgetting that we're only part of science. Is there any discussion with what's going on with the rest of science in terms of publications? What are other fields doing?
Different types
of material they need to present, things like that.
That's right. Some fields are doing more, and I don't have detailed information. The American Geophysical Union, I had a meeting at which they were present at the American Institute of Physics, and there was a computer there, and I showed some of these folks the Los Alamos archive. They'd never seen it. And then that you could search it and do all that kind of stuff, and it was all for free. And I think I left them fairly disturbed, but I don't know. But we'll see what happens. That hasn't happened yet either. But look, there's an awful lot of fuss about, you know, the copyright issues, this question of the priority and who published first and whether you're allowed. There are some journals that will allow you to, like I think the Geophysical Journal, allow you to publish something that has been posted on a bulletin board. They will at least relax the criteria so far. They don't consider posting on the bulletin board prior publication, in which case it would be not. But you have to take it off if it goes onto their into their journal. That sounds silly here, but it's a high point of the whole philosophy of publication in the old days, and we have to think about what it's got. Look, the physics community certainly has been way out ahead in, it invented the web, the Los Alamos archive has spread to some other areas of science. It's going to be a while before this happens in general.
There's still the ATS ePrint server.
Yeah.
Sure. It has to be really bad. One of the biggest advantages of the Los Alamos archive is there's only one of them. You don't have to read through half a dozen journals.
Yeah, well, that's
you wouldn't want to compete. I don't see what the point is of competing with that.
No, what you want to do is get everything as tightly linked as possible.
Actually, I might point out that I maintain a web page for Bose-Einstein condensation, which basically does the searching for you, and nobody looks at the e-print. Everybody looks at this. They see the new stuff. They click on it. It goes directly to the e-print. So that saves 1,000 people from having to do the same search.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it probably an S by epsilon lowers the traffic on the e-print as far as doing searching and so on.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised there's not more of that in other fields.
I would like to take one piece of the thing.
You're free to do whatever you want besides look at this. It's just a resource.
Right.
But is it refereeing? Do you put only things that you believe are correct?
We put everything we see. We don't care. We don't even...
Well,
we,
I would be interested...
We do not judge it at all.
I won't
look at it.
Yeah, fine. Okay, I understand. But I would like to hear about examples where people do judge it and do provide a kind of overlay that follows me talking for...
Yeah, but that's a tough issue.
We should try to get him.
Well, let's thank Jerry.